Torah uses the expression, Eile Toldos Noach. These are the descendants, or the products of Noach. Noach, Ish Sadiq, Tomim Hoyob Derosov. Noach was a very righteous man in his generation. Now, Hirsch notes that Noach, it emphasizes, the Torah says that he himself, Eile told us Noach, Noach. It's like saying that not his children, but he himself is being his first product. Toldo means product, something that is produced, that comes about. So it seems that Noach himself is his first product. So he says this gives our sages the opportunity to teach us that the first product, the first result of his work, is his own character. And this would especially be true in the time of Noach, Hirsch says, when he lived in an environment where require really working on oneself to work himself up to the level of purity and goodness. And Ish Tzadik Hoyo, to work himself up to the most noble character of Ish Tzadik, this is what found favor in the eyes of Hashem. But on this point that the person's major or first aspect of his consideration of what he should accomplish in this world is himself. Sometimes this is overlooked. We always speak about, we get caught up in the idea of working for our children and becoming a link in the future. But it seems that the person could overlook himself too, because he's always living for the future. It tells us that a person should first work on himself to be his own tolada. In addition to that, the way to accomplish to others is by setting an example. That if you want to have children, we're not speaking physically children here, we're speaking children who will be worthy of repopulating the world. So the person, the parent himself, has to show the example. So in a sense, before he influences his children, told us Noah, he has to influence himself. And this is part of the aspect of having children, when you look at it that way. Part of being a parent is preparing oneself for parenthood. What's the idea of preparing oneself for parenthood? By working on one's own midas tavis, so that the children and the descendants will have an opportunity to have someone to emulate. And the story is told of many gedolim. I don't know which one it's true, but the idea is proper. That when he wanted to influence others, he went and originally went to France, and he thought he would be able to influence Paris. At that time was the city most needing of spiritual rejuvenation. And he saw that it wasn't effective, so then he thought he would try his own country in Poland, but it also wasn't effective. And then he thought he would try his own city, and it wasn't effective. And he thought he'd try his family, and it wasn't effective. So then he tried himself. He worked on himself. In that way, he had an influence on his family, his city, his country, and the world. And he was known, they say it on the Chofetz Chaim and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, they say it on various people whose influence indeed spread. So when you're speaking about tolada, tolada means something that you produce, the aspect is that you should produce yourself first. Rabbi Feinstein, Zachen Levracha, also stops on this point, on Ish Tzadik Tomim Hoya B'Dereisov. And he says that, just like Rashi says, that the Masim Tovim of a Tzadik are also something that he produces. Really, because when you think into tolda, a child, it means something that you produce. If you produce Masim Tovim, so you also are producing something positive. So he notes the aspect that the same way a person looks at his own children, the same way he should look at his masim, at his deeds. We're not speaking that to say two children are enough, so two mitzvahs are enough. But the idea we mean is that a person always wants the best for his children. He always tries to perfect his children. There's never enough that you can do for your children. So in a sense, when your good deeds that you represent or strive to present to mankind, those same good deeds should have the same determination of your efforts and the same love and concern that one has for his children. when you think into it, it means that a person should be so concerned with the mitzvah of davening or the mitzvah of tefillin, almost as if this would be a child of his, involving a child of his. When he involves a child of his, he has his primary concern. So when he has to do with a mitzvah, he should have the same enthusiasm. We know, of course, that we have a long way to strive for it. So this is what the emphasis is on Noah. Now, we know at the same, there are others, you know, you can never do it completely right. There are others that say, Lignai, Yesh Dorshim L'Shvach. I mean, some say that Noah, Ish Tzadik, he was a Tzadik in his generation, but in Avram's he would not be. Others say, no, that even in his generation, surely in Avram Avinu's generation, there are two ways to look at it. What difference was there between Noah and between Avram? So it said that Avram, we know, went out looking for other people. Noah, in a sense, tried only to contain himself, tried only to work on himself. It was much more difficult, it seems, for him to work on himself. Avram Avinu was able to work on others. Well, some say that if he would have been in the generation of Avram, he wouldn't have been considered from the great people. So there are two ways, but others say no, that Noah was a tzaddik. So once a magid said that the Torah says Noah is tzaddik tomim hoya b'dereisa. What more could you want? It says that Noah was a total tzaddik in his deris. Yet Rashi brings the medrash yesh dorshin lignai. So he says by our people Nevach, he says you could be told by God could tell you Noah is tzaddik tomim hoya b'dereisa, that Noah was the greatest tzaddik. You'll still find yesh dorshim. You'll find some people around who will say, no, he wasn't such a big tzaddik, like, nah, you know. So he says, homiletically, we always find yesh dorshim. There's always others that question Noah's ability, even if God attests to the fact that Noah was this great tzaddik. Now, her stops in detail on the pasuk of, in sentence 10, where it says that Noah had three sons, Shem, Chom, and Yopes. Now, he says that the Torah wants to tell us this for a purpose, because when Hashem was going to repopulate the world after the destruction, what type of people would there be in the world? What type of characteristics? So first we'll discuss it. He discusses it from the characteristics of the human race. The characteristics of the human race are composed of Shem, Chom, and Yopes. Now, what is Shem, what is Chom, and what is Yopes? So he says Shem comes from the word name, the conception of objects. He says the wisdom of man, or of mankind, is the ability to give things names. Really, when you give a name is more than just a name. A name shows that you understand totally the essence of this item, of this object, for example, and the name expresses that understanding. When Adam Arishan named all the beasts and all the animals, he understood the names of these beasts and animals. He understood the essence of that. Last week, Cedra. In fact, I once, from the words, I brought this as a very clear proof. It says there that Hashem brought unto Adam all the chayas asode and the of hashamayim. He brought all the beasts and the fowl to see that name that Adam will give them. It's almost like a test. See, first God had said that let Adam be, and this will come out clearly, in man's relationship with beast. In this week's Sedra, we're going to read that it's a relationship of fear. It says, God says to Noah after the flood, Umorachem v'chitchem yiyu al kol chayas oretz. Your fear and your dread will be over all the beasts. In Bereshis, in the end of the first chapter, it says there that Urdu bidgas ayom ve'eif hashamayim, that kivshua, God says to Adam, he says to him, Urdu bidgas ayom ve'eif hashamayim uvechol chayo romeshes alo oretz. You're supposed to have dominion over the fish, etc., in the sea. Now, there's a big difference from dominion to fear. Dominion means you could be a governor, you rule. I mean, they have to have an authority. You have to have a governor, a leader. Fear means that you're a totalitarian dictator, in a sense. They have a natural dread. Before the flood, we'll see there was no need for this fear. There was an idea of a dominion. Things changed with the flood. But if you're a dominion, if you have dominion over something, you really have to understand that which you have dominion over. Because you can't really, if you're going to rule with fear, then obviously you don't have to understand anybody. You just have a good machine gun or a whip in your hand and everybody understands you. But if you're going to be or do bitgas hayom beiva shemayim, if you're going to lead everybody in a spirit of unity, and so you really have to understand how to approach people. You have to understand which direction to take, how to talk to them. So God first gave him, if we read like in the beginning, he gave him the command, or do bitgas hayom beiva shemayim, I want you to be a governor, to be a leader. Then later it says that God tested Adam, that God formed the animals of the field and the beasts of the Shemayim, and he brought them to Adam, liros ma yikralei, to see what Adam will name them. And everything that Adam will name them, hushmo, that is his name. So he gave Adam the opportunity, first of all, liros ma yikralei, the phrase, to see what he will name them. It seems, in a sense, when you voice it that way, it's almost a test of Adam's ability to name them. Everything that Adam will name him, that will be his name. So when you look at both phrases together, it means Adam was indeed supposed to live with these beasts. He was supposed to live with these animals. He had to understand their temperament. He had to understand the conditions. So let's see what Adam will name him. I mean, because Adam's going to have to understand them. And then it says, in every understanding that Adam had of it, that will be his name. So it says that Adam named all the behemoths, the ape and the chai, it says in the next sentence. Well, Adam le motza ezer connected. He didn't find any one to for him. Now, the Chazal say that means that if you take it literally, like he consorted with everyone in a physical sense. Now, that wouldn't that's how it's literal. But some of the commentaries, I believe, are saying that not that he actually tested them physically to see if that would be a suited mate, but it means le motza ezer kenegdei. Once he analyzed what type of a character this is, what type of characteristics, he realized that this has a different breed, that this could not be the mate of man, because if man needed a mate, he needed someone who was of intelligence and wisdom and understanding, not, we'll say, just for physical procreation. So you don't have to say that actually he consorted with all the beasts in the field. Even if we would say that, that wouldn't be a question, because we look at it as being a terrible thing. And obviously it's the most abominable, detestable concept, because by us we have the idea of Tov V'ra. This goes into the question of Tov V'ra. Like the commentaries point out, they didn't know they were naked. Why didn't they know they were naked in last week's Sedra? Because they knew they were naked, but naked didn't mean anything to them, because they knew Tov, they knew truth, Sheker and Emes. Sheker and Emes, there was no such thing as good, bad, desirable, seductive, passionate. These are all concepts of Tov V'ra. But Sheker and Emes is absolute. There was no such thing. Nakedness is a question when you come into shame. By them, procreation was the idea, just like a person would eat something. It's just an act to do without any sensual, without any emotions, without any feelings. It was just an act to do because Emes, that is true. If you look at it that way, so reproduction could be anything in the world. The whole question of abominable, detestable, unconscionable, that has no validity to do an act which is true or false. So therefore, even if you would say that he consorted with them at that stage of development, it wouldn't be anything comparable to envision in our time. But Hirsch says that it wasn't a question of consorting, it was just a question of the depth and the understanding of Adam. Now, to prove his understanding, it says there in sentence 19, when Hashem brings it to him, it says in 2:19, if you notice the language, God formed kol chayas asodeh, the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air, the birds of the air, he brought them to Adam. No mention is made of a behemoth, of an animal, right? It just says chayas asodeh. We know there are two things. There are beasts, and their animals. Now, if you look in 20, when it says that Ogham gave them names, there it says already, La Behema Ula'eif Hashamayim. Where did the Behema creep in? We weren't speaking about a Behema. The answer is, the way we're saying it makes good sense. Why? Because what really is the difference from a Behema to a Chaya? Certain species are categorized as beasts, certain are categorized as animals. Now, it doesn't go by size. It doesn't, you could fool you. Sometimes you think it's an animal, turns out to be a beast. You look at, you know, even we, certain species can be confused. Is it an animal or is it a beast? What is a deer? Is it an animal? Is it a beast? A deer. I mean, there are certain things. So the answer is, it depends on the nature of the beast that you're talking about. They all look the same. They're all basically made the same. But an animal lets itself be domesticated. An animal serves man. Whereas a beast is wild, and you really can't tame the beast. Now, how do you know the distinction from an animal and a beast? With wisdom, you can understand the difference in the characteristics. Now, Hashem didn't say anything. It said, whatever Adam understands, and that's it, he's going to live with it. Whatever, we'll see what he calls it. So he brought all the chayas asoda. Obviously, there's a difference from a bird to an animal, right? But the beast and the animal was all one. It was chayas asoda. There was no a way of having something, a domesticated service, because there was no service yet. They all were in the field, and they all came to him. The chol asher yikra le'odom, Odom understood, though, when he looked at a cow and he looked at a lion. They were both standing there. He understood the difference, that a cow is a cow that will serve man, that's a behemoth that gives milk. And a lion, you have to keep your eyes open for a lion, because a lion is vicious, and it's So he saw the difference. So that's why in sentence 20, when it says that Adam called them, it then makes the distinction between Chaya and Behemoth, because already that showed his wisdom and his knowledge. So Adam here was the father, the Redu. Now we're getting back to what we were speaking a little earlier. Man has to have these basic ingredients. So what do we say that meant that he originally had three sons? One was Shem, one was Chom, and one was Yafes. Now Shem means the wisdom of man, the ability to give things names. That shows wisdom, to be able to express conceptions. So that's Shem. Chom means excitement, from Cham, sensual. Cham means heat. Yafes means beauty, from Yofet. So now, these are three aspects which go into the person, into a human being. So to quote Hirsch, we have here three factors which comprise the whole of the life of our mind. In a healthy life, he says, all of these parts of man place themselves under one higher principle. Principle, the service of God. Hisaleich Noach. Es Elikim Hisaleich Noach. Noach, which had within him these three distinct characteristics of man, were all under God. Es Elikim Hisaleich Noach means the highest potentiality of the mind. Tomim means that he's totally truthful, the highest power over his senses. And in Tzadik, it's the purest power over the will and the efforts. So Shem would be the thinking one. Chom would be the sensuous one. Yofeh would be the one who seeks beauty. That's like Greek and so on, philosophy, art. So Shem is supposed to go under Hisaleich Es Hashem. That would be man's intellectual understanding following the directives of God. Chom means passion and so on, but he has to curb that and to be lies tomim, to be complete. And Yofes, instead of being guided by beauty, has to be tzaddik. So in a sense, tzaddik, tomim b'derosov eser lekim yisalech noach, shows what the perfect man is, that he has within him Shem, Chom, and Yofes, but he's able to subdue them or subjugate them and put them under the idea of eser lehim yisalech noach. And therefore, later, when it says that they went out from out of the flood, so it says, "Vayiu bnei Noach hayotzi min hateva, shem chom v'yofes." The whole humanity would come from them. It says, "Shlosha eile, these three, were the sons of Noah, and Me'elah and Noftzah Ha'aretz. And from these three sons, the entire world spread out. So the idea is that it was very important to use all of these three as part of the sons of Noah. That's what humanity would come forth from. And Hirsch goes into great, great detail as to, goes into a chapter, page after page, in showing us how these people developed. We may get back to that, and they developed into the entire humanity. Now, we find, it says there that Kol remeh asher uchai, lachem yeh la'ochlo. Everything that is living will be to you for food. Ki yerek esev nasati lachem es kol. I have given you like the green herb I have given you all. We know that before the flood, they couldn't eat everything. There was no such thing as meat. In fact, the food, some say, was the same food that the animal ate, same food the person ate. Others interpret, no, going in the phrase of in Bereshis, where it says there that, basing it, they say that man ate fruit plus the vegetables that reproduce like fruit, for example, like tomatoes or pickles or cucumbers. That's what man would eat. The animals would eat like the spinach and the lettuce. The animals would eat the grass. Yerek Esev, that's called Yerek Esev. That's how the food was divided before the flood. Now after the flood, so man received a different kind of food. Why he received this food, many reasons are given. But we may touch on it indirectly. Let me just quote from Hirsch. He says the following. With the altered conditions of life, he said, mankind also received fresh kind of food. It is not unlikely that the reason was because of the shortened duration of life. Everything the earlier generations lived through in 700 to 800 years had to be concentrated into 70 to 80 years. So the fact was, he said, that this quicker life, the quicker development, and the changes stipulated for animal food. So in a sense, what he's saying, for man to be able to work at a greater, it seems at a quicker pace, he needed more nourishment, which he received from animal food. The differences in temperature, he says, could equally have been that, because before the flood, and we had discussed once previously, the world had a total different climate. The temperature was more constant, vegetation was more luxurious, so vegetarian food was always available and there was no problem. But after the flood, there became a problem as to how people would be able to live. So it seems for their needs, he emphasizes that they gave them a meat diet. In fact, Hirsch wants to say that the Torah doesn't demand vegetarianism. It has no aversion to eating meat. It even makes it a duty to do that on Yontif. So, but whatever it was, he says, if our physical condition was still the original one, the eating of meat probably would not have been permitted to us. So he contends that it's purely because of the physical condition of man. That's one change that took place because of man's extreme physical condition. In addition, another change we see where it says, V'atem pruervu, that you be fruitful. Shirtzu ba'oretz ervu bo. Another introduction, the word shirtzu ba'oretz. What does shirtzu mean? Sheretz means swarm. Now, by Adam HaRishon, we didn't find the word shirtzu ba'oretz. It just said there, pru ervu, umilu es oretz. Milu is a finer expression than shirtzu es oretz. Shrotzim, we use the term for all crawling, creeping objects. Milu would mean one type of a breed that would just spread out and fill up the world. Shrotzim means it seems everybody's going at a different pace without any direct design. So Hirsch says that this was a basic difference, that this was, God wanted it that way. After the flood, it was necessary for this to be to guarantee that the world will not reach its original state that it had before of degeneration. How can you see that? It won't become that degenerative. So he says the following, just to give a few quotes, which is a novel idea. He says it here, he goes to the basis, beginning of the word sherets, and he would say, here accordingly, it would be a description of a diversity and a variety of human races. And Boorets on the earth, under the influence of the different lands, Shirtzu become different varieties, Boorets from the influence of the land. Not only Shirtzu Boorets, not only, he says, the physical, but also Revu Bo, the physical and the moral and intellectual education equally will be under the same influences. Intellectually, the person, not only will his physical features be influenced by the land, but intellectually he also will be influenced by the land. For example, he says, originally we see this, I'll go back to that shortly, and he says, the Noahite mankind is given the mission to spread over the whole world, and under the most diverse conditions and influences of climate and physical nature, to become man and develop one common real characteristic of man. What will the common characteristic of man be? It will be a diversity and a multiplicity which appeared to us in the above, as we spoke about, as God's new plan for the education of mankind to avoid any fresh total catastrophe. That means that Hashem is so made that man will be spread out. And they point out that every race will feel at ease in its homeland, even under the most inhospitable circumstances, it's so true, and the most unfriendly districts affect the sons with homesickness when they are away from them and in strange lands disturbs their spiritual development. Man who thinks he is a master of the land is many way in his innermost self, understanding, speech, mastered by his native land, and this variety of countries has a purpose. Why does it have a purpose? Because the idea is, if man is all together and living all together, then we don't know how he can become degenerative. The influence of one immediately has a result on the influence of another. But if they're separate, swarming, even in the difficult conditions, people think, this is my home. I wouldn't trade it for no place at all. You speak to people living in New York. I love New York. I can't understand how they love New York. But Lamai said they would never leave New York, right? I mean, they would never leave it. You'll speak to somebody who's in South America in the most difficult, but this is his home. He feels this. So this, in a sense, will guarantee that all of mankind, to a degree, will not become degenerate at one time. That means it's not going to spread, because each person, what you consider to be fine and nice, he really doesn't consider it to be fine and nice. And in that same vein, if you follow that, you could go, some want to say that that is the question at the end of the chapter. When they were dealing with the Tower of Babel, they once again wanted to unite and not be ben nofutz al pnei kol ha'aretz. And if they would all unite under one tower and they would all be the same thoughts, that was the idea of Sofo Achas Udvorim Achodim, where it says at the end, all of man had one tongue and one dialect. The idea was, like we spoke earlier by Adam, the name gave man the understanding of the item. So here also, if all of mankind understood everything the same, and the same idea he follows a little earlier, in verse 21 it says, I will not curse man because the inclination of man is evil from his youth. We'll talk about that if we have a moment later. And I won't punish man. Then it says like this, Od kol yemei ha'aretz, zera v'kotzir, v'kor v'chom, v'kayitz v'choref, v'yayim v'layla, le'yish besu. In a sense, originally, it says, all the days of the earth shall be there perpetually. Seed time, and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, shall not cease from working. Hirsch says, you could learn that It means after the flood, the previous seasons, the changes of seasons and so on, would not be interrupted anymore. It would be like it was before. But he says that the traditions handed down to us, meaning from Midrashim, and even the geologists, quoting some geologists, they say that the world was totally different before the flood. It says, according to Reb Yitzchak, they only cultivated the fields once in 40 years. So that means they only had to go and work out in the field once in 40 years, and the season was like last week. Eternal spring rained without an A. I mean, the idea was that it was a beautiful weather, and it was so pleasant, and the people didn't have to do any work. Hoyolahem avir yofe kemin Pesach aratzeres, like from Pesach to Shavuos, which is springtime, they had this pure air. And hoyu mahalchi misofo elam, there were no continents. So people could walk from one end of the world. They could drive, we'll say, or walk. Then have to worry about ships and planes to the other end of the world. So he says the seasons of the year mentioned in our verse are definitely declared in the Medrash to have been post-diluvian innovations, after the flood. Mikan ve'elach zera v'kotzir, seasons changed. You had to plant every year and sow every year. So much so, he says, that Reb Shmuel Bar Nachman, who had headaches, so he jokingly said, I have to thank the generation of the flood for my headaches, because the climatic stability which obtained before the flood caused people any allergies or anything. It was a mechayev. But the problem was, it was like Gan Eden, but man has to know what to do with his time in Gan Eden. But what, the Medrash continues, what caused man constantly to rebel against God? Because they didn't know what to do. Ma goram lahem, because le'al yedei she'ezerim v'lei ketrin, yoldim v'lei kevrin. So it says the following, they would plant, and there would forever be seeds. They wouldn't have to plant again once in 40 years. They had children, and they lived almost, who knows, forever. So they were living such long periods. So what are they going to do with their time? So that's where the trouble began. That's where man became degenerate, because man also was very strong, very powerful, and he had everything needed. So how could he not sin? In fact, there's in the Medrash, just as an aside, in last week's Sedra, it says there that these Nephilim that grew out from the Bnei Elohim, which some interpret from the lords who came and took women, Mikol Asher Bechoru, from whomever they wanted. So some say it means angels. These were the fallen angels, that they came to speak against man. Look at man, he's so degenerate, he takes married women, there is no keeping of moral laws. So God gave them the opportunity and transformed them into men to see how they would fare. So they weren't any better, it says. Mikol Asher Bechoru. There were many daughters, it says, they could have married unwarried ones, but Mikol Asher Bechoru. So it seems that the climate was such that there was so much wealth, they had no worries, so man just became degenerate. So now, this change that took place, Hirsch says, in the climatic conditions, the geological change and so on, and also as he goes into consideration the shortening of the years of man's life, this would serve as a guarantee that mankind would never reach the depth of depravity that it had reached before the flood and that caused the flood to come. So in that vein, this is the same that he's saying here. He's saying here also that these are reasons. Pruvu shirtzu be'oretz ervuvo. On the words, shirtzu be'oretz ervuvo, swarm out around the earth and become mastered by the earth yourself. So this also was a reason that Hashem had made that man should not succumb to sin itself. So these were two of the changes that took place in the world after the flood. It says, Es kashti nosati be'onon, ve'hoiso le'os beris, be'ni uveno oretz. My rainbow I have put up into the clouds. And this would be for a sign of the covenant between be'ni uveno oretz, between mankind. Now, the idea of a rainbow, what is the meaning of the rainbow, the origin of this rainbow? So that has evoked a lot of discussion as to what the rainbow really means, because we're dealing here with nature. So just to quote some of the comments on the significance of the rainbow. First, Hirsch's idea of the rainbow is, it's a sign only to remind man of the covenant with God. Just as there are other signs, like tefillin, Shabbos, the bris, all of these are signs of covenants. So the rainbow reminds us that there is a covenant between man and God not to destroy mankind. So whenever after the rain, which could have been a powerful rain, a tornado, and you'll take a look and you'll see the rainbow, you'll know that it could not have been total destruction of mankind. That's called bris. In fact, later in Vayikra, everything is subjects on their own, it speaks there of the teicheche, of the God telling the Jewish people of the terrible calamities that will happen if they don't listen unto God. So one point there it says, and if you go with me bekeri, meaning if you just haphazardly go with God, what does it mean haphazardly? You don't antagonize God. But if God fits into your lifestyle, you'll gladly welcome him. That's bekeri, mikra, perchance you happen to agree with God's lifestyle, God agrees with your lifestyle. There are some who are rishoyim, who are antagonistic. Some are not antagonistic, but if it fits in with your direction, your political aspiration, the direction, so it's fine. You could learn that as I once said into certain parties, political parties in Israel. Some are antagonistic to Frumkai, to religious, and others, if it fits in with theirs, so they're very happy. But God says, so if you go with me, Bekeri, he says, I will also go with you, Bechamas Keri, with the vengeance of Keri, and I will bring through your land, Cherev no Kemes Bris, a sword which takes vengeance for the covenant. Now they ask, what does this mean? I mean, it seems that they didn't do anything worse, and all of a sudden he's going to take a vengeance of the covenant, and what covenant? So Hirsch learns a novel pshat there. He says, this is the covenant of Noah. What does that mean? God had said that I won't let the world be destroyed because I won't let mankind, the way we're seeking, totally become enveloped in destruction. Now, how will God save that? There will be wars. There will be other things which will make people separate and so on. So sometimes he won't let it reach the level when it would have to be absolute destruction. There'll be a sword there, that the sword will take vengeance at a certain period, so man will not go ahead and be ruined. Now, if Syria wants to wage war against Egypt, why? Because God has determined that the time is for Syria to wage war against Egypt in order that to keep man from doing worse things. Now, they have to get to Egypt. The natural way for them to get to Egypt is to go through Israel. They'll go right through Israel, and if heads fly, I mean, that's it. But we say that the Ribbono Shel Olam, that would be the nature for one country to go to war against the other, and they'll go right through you in an occupying country. But we have, of course, that God will be the Shomer Yisrael. He'll provide the umbrella, that Israel will not fall in the natural order of events where they will suffer. So it says, but if you just use God when he suits you, but you don't go out of your way to please him, so therefore this Cherev no Kemes Bris, which is also a natural order of events, I'm not going to bring him special, but if it's destined for the order of mankind that this Cherev should be no Kem Bris, you're going to have to suffer because you don't give me any special consideration, I don't give you any special consideration. So this is the way Hirsch interprets Bris. First, and the original Bris, for all of mankind, God has said, I assure you I won't destroy all of mankind totally with a marble. But there will be ideas brought in to destroy man. It's not popular to say that plagues and scourges that may occur because of evil acts that man has practiced. It's not a very popular thing to say. But the truth is, that can be, we don't know, but it can possibly be a way of punishment of man, that the world should not sink to the level where there should have been a necessity as a result of their level to bring a flood. This would be categorized what Hirsch would call cherev nokemes bris. There are about 20 interpretations that are brought down here about the rainbow. Some say that the rainbow is a sign that if it wouldn't be for the mercy of God, you're worthy of destruction at this point. It's a lesson for man to better himself. And if that's the lesson for man to better himself, so in a sense, you've got the message, you're not supposed to gaze at it, you're supposed to. I mean, so each one tries to learn that into it. The first question is, what's this a new phenomenon? Now, if you learn Pirkei Avos, like Hirsch points out, it always existed. According to him, the rainbows weren't first created after the flood, because indeed, in Pirkei Avos, it says that the rainbow was one of the 10 things which took place Erev Shabbos, Bein HaShemashos. So he says the idea was that what took place after the flood was that this rainbow that was created became a sign. It became a sign. God created this. It was always there. But he used this creation that was always there. Not that it was a new natural phenomenon that was occurred. It was always there. We didn't know what it was there for. But it was there for God to use it as a sign sometimes for mankind. And to go further, according to Hirsch, it would be a sign that man would continue to exist. Now he says, in a different place, Hirsch, and this is really beautiful, when he takes the rainbow apart, he says, and we would appreciate it, it's almost like Jackson with his rainbow coalition. The term, I wouldn't be surprised. So Hirsch goes like this, we got it, he says, I'm sure he didn't read Hirsch, but he says the following, the rainbow, he says, is the rainbow anything else but the one pure, complete ray of light, which is broken up into 7 degrees of 7 colors, from the red rays nearest to the light, to the violet, which is most distant from the light, losing itself into the darkness. And then it like disappears, the rainbow, from the violet color into the darkness. And from one to the other, are they not all rays of light? And combined all together, do they not form the one complete, pure white ray? So he says, perhaps this is meant to say that the whole manifold variety of all living creatures, from the most alive, Adam, which I'll go into a moment, man, nearest to godly, down to the lowest, humblest form of life, in the humblest worm, all nefesh chayo b'chol b'asor, and above all, the variety of shades in the purely human, would show itself in the races of mankind. God recognizes there will be all of these rainbows, all of these colors of the rainbow. What they all have is that there is this spiritual element of light. In the violet that hardly glimmers, it almost dissipates, yet there is this spirit in man, in all colors of the rainbow, and therefore this is a sign that God, and what unites them all together, he says, the spiritual element, God unites them all together in one common bond of peace. All fragments of one life, refracted rays from the Spirit of God, because even the smallest light is also a son of the light. So in a sense, this is a sign that humanity, whatever humanity it is, it's composed of from the red to the violet, but that will forever remain. Now, Hirsch emphasizes red because he has a unique interpretation of the word Adam, man. In last week's Sedra, man, the human being was given the gift of life from God, breath of spirit, and he was called Adam, man. Now, commonly we interpret it, why is he called Adam? Because he comes from the Adama, he comes from the earth. Well, every creation was from the earth. I mean, if Adam is unique, then why do you call him Adam? Every creation is from the earth. In fact, we also find the Gemara, the Chazal tell us, when it speaks about the Nefesh Yisrael, the Jewish soul, which we feel is destined because of his Mamle, the kingdom, holy nation, is the supposed to be the shining light. So it speaks of that Jewish soul, and it says, Atem kruyim Adam. You Jewish people are called Adam. Ve'enu mesa'olam kruyim Adam. Other man is not called Adam. In fact, we learn out laws from this, that a Kohen from the Torah law, not the rabbinic law, but from Torah law, a Kohen could walk into a building where there's a deceased, if that deceased there is not Jewish. Because it says, Adam ki yamus ba'ohel. If a person, Adam atem kuyim Adam. Now, what does that mean, atem kuyim Adam? Now, it's a very difficult concept to explain, even when you look in Pirkei Avos, the Tosfos Yontif, and others. But Hirsch has a very interesting explanation. And with this passage here of the rainbow, we could appreciate the explanation, because Hirsch says, just like you have here, for example, he says seven types of light. He says we also find our sages describe the different spiritual and moral degrees of tzaddikim in the metaphors of nuances of light, from the bright illuminating rays of the sun to the gleam of the lamp in the temple. And he quoted the Chazal of the Medrash the following, Sheva kitois shel tzaddikim. There are seven groupings of righteous people. Upneihem, and their countenances, domos are likened, lechama to sun, lelavona to the moon, lerakia to the heavens, lebrokim to like a shine of a cloud, of a ray, lekechovim to stars, leshashanim to flowers, Liminoras beis hamikdash. So these are degrees of light which the tzaddik is likened to. So the idea of Adam, Hirsch says, doesn't come from Adama. That's no compliment to call man Adama. Everybody's Adama, every creation. Adam means red. The greatest red light here that he's speaking here about the color, the same idea there. Man has the spiritual strength. He is Adam. And therefore he says, why is it termed Adam? It comes like Hadom, which is the footstool of God. Man was made here, as like we said earlier in the shir, as the governor, meaning God's representative to rule over society, to rule over the universe. So that's why he was called Adam. He says Adama got its name from Adam, not Adam from Adama. But since the physical part of man came from the earth, they called this Adama. But it's called Adama. But really, Adam means the spiritual light of man, and that is the unique significance of man. Now, it's not just like we say here in a rainbow coalition. We say here you have 7 degrees of light. So we could also understand the idea of Atem Kruim Adam, because you as a Jew are representative or should be more concerned with the spiritual level of mankind. And therefore, Atem Kruim Adam, after Adam had passed on, who of the descendants from Shem, but who of the descendants will constitute the true descendant or comprise the true descendant of Adam Arishan to be worthy of the name of Adam? That's the Bnei Yisrael who are Mekabel Taryag Mitzvahs, and therefore their obligation to affirm to the teachings of the Spirit of God is that much greater. And that would be the meaning of Atem Kruyim Adam. So, with understanding the way he says here with the rainbow, we could appreciate the whole idea of Klal Yisrael being the Adam, as he says. And also the idea of the sign of the rainbow, the sign of the rainbow being that all of man is worthy because even the violet has within him the Spirit of God. So man is worthy of existing and not being totally destroyed. This is just one idea. As I said, they bring about 18 different interpretations of the rainbow.